Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney. The program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, we're on the road again, as they say, in our mobile studio today in Dallas, Texas. And we're very pleased to be coming to you with a very important first guest, a woman that I have come to know and admire tremendously over the space of the past year, as she has become one of the most important contributors to, among other things, our sovereignty coalition. And we're going to be talking about that and what else she is doing. But let me first say, Dr. Meryl Nass is a frontline doctor who distinguished herself, among others, for standing up for her patients' rights despite what she was told was the approved way of treating them in connection with the COVID-19 pandemic. She is associated not only with our Sovereignty Coalition, she has founded her own terrific organization, Door to Freedom. You can find it at doortofreedom.org. She's also a scientific advisor to yet another important member of our team, and that would be Children's Health Defense. Dr. Nass has been in the front lines of both the medical part of the fight, but also the policy fight. And we're going to be talking with her about both in the course of our interview today. Meryl, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, glad to be back.
I wanted to start by level setting a little bit, informed by your own experience. A man who played an outsized role in what we were told we could and could not do about the pandemic COVID-19 crisis was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, who is the Director General of the World Health Organization, or WHO. Tell us a little bit about what we were advised by Dr. Tedros to do in the course of that pandemic and what it resulted in.
When COVID-19 hit us, our public health officials threw out the playbook on how you respond to pandemics, and for some odd reason started following the advice of the World Health Organization, which was issued by Dr. Ghebreyesus, who is not a physician, has a PhD in community health. We don't know why that happened. It was not obligatory at the time. But the goal of both the United States government and the WHO is to make that advice obligatory in future.
And making it obligatory based on what we saw was the quality of the advice the last time around is a pretty chilling prospect. Talk a little bit about the China model that was, I guess, yes, at the core of what he was advising previously and what that might mean for the future.
I don't think you could find a more authoritarian so-called public health model when people are actually welded into their apartment buildings, prevented from shopping, prevented from getting fresh air, forced to wear masks, and the social credit system was there to punish them immediately if they got out of line. There were similar
is in China you're talking about.
Yeah. So this is what happened in China. But if you are in Chile or Spain or Germany or Austria, you are also to be punished if you left your home when you weren't allowed to. The China model is extraordinarily strict. The rules are completely top down. And Tedros suggested to the world that we all follow the China model. As we now know, using our retrospectoscope, there was no benefit whatsoever in terms of mortality or morbidity. Lots of people around the world starved to death or were impoverished as a result of shutting the world down for very prolonged periods of time. And the WHO did not even have the expertise to issue these guidelines. Where did it come from? They don't have the experts.
Yeah, well, it seems as though it came from communist China, as best I can tell, hence the term China model. But talk as a doctor, talk about what it meant, both in terms of the care for those who were afflicted with this, biological warfare attack by the Chinese Communist Party, on the one hand, Marilyn, also the patient-doctor relationship as well.
Yeah. You know, we take an oath to be there for the patient, that we are not taking an oath to obey the government or to obey the insurance company or the pharmaceutical company. And so the doctor-patient relationship is very sacred. It means when that patient is in the room with me, I'm not collecting data, you know, for someone's model. I'm not sharing that data with the WHO as is desired in the future, but I'm there just trying to figure out what's best for that patient. Now, what was best for the patients during COVID was to give them hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, vitamin D, aspirin, possibly other drugs to suppress inflammation or to suppress thrombosis, because there were many facets to the illness. We were told not to do that. We were told to do nothing for them until their lips turned blue and then send them to the emergency room where they could be put on a ventilator. And as we know, when the first article was published out of New York City by the Northwell system, 88% of people who were put on ventilators died. Patients were begging me to not go to the hospital. Please don't send me to the hospital. Do something else. And if this China WHO model is followed in the future, it will be illegal for me to do anything else. As it is, yeah. I lost my medical license because of it.
Yeah. A firsthand story of punishment under an advisory system, no less. Meryl, one of the pieces of this that I just wanted to calibrate with you on, I believe it was Dr. Robert Malone who said on our program that he estimated that something on the order of 80% of the roughly 1.2 million Americans who have perished as a result of this disease did so needlessly because they were not given access to the kind of medical care that you've recommended and been punished for recommending.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I think it was at least 80%. So let me say that by February of 2020, we knew the Chinese were having good luck with the chloroquine drugs. It also turned out NIH and CDC had published papers showing that the chloroquine drugs, hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, and another one, mefloquine, were very effective in tissue culture at killing the SARS viruses and the MERS-related virus. We also knew by April, this FDA knew this, by April of 2020, that ivermectin was effective against COVID. And the use of these drugs was suppressed in over 50 different ways around the world, at the state level, federal level, level of the manufacturer, the distributor, the pharmaceutical, the drug stores, many different ways. Doctors were being, and pharmacists were encouraged or not even given the drugs so they could distribute them, to not use these effective drugs. Had we been able to use them and vitamin D and aspirin, we could have stopped this pandemic in its tracks. Most people would never have gotten it. Very few people would have died, and we would never have needed to roll out the vaccines. And again, looking backwards, I think the fact that these treatments were suppressed was in order to prolong the pandemic until they could roll out the vaccines, which then killed, you know, even more people and have injured so many millions.
Indeed. And among other things, contributed to, as did the rest of the China model, you know, mass destruction in our economy and our society, of our freedoms, no less. Which brings me to Tedros Ghebreyesus and the role that he would be playing, if not one, but two treaties, properly understood treaties that are in the works now, Meryl and us, as you know. They're supposed to be approved by something called the World Health Assembly between May 27th and June 7th. And we're going to talk on the other side of a very short break about what exactly they will entail, especially given what Tedros Ghebreyesus has already said he thinks constitute public health emergencies of international concern. You're going to want to catch all of this with Dr. Meryl Nass. Stay tuned on the other side of this short break. Be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The people who brought us the COVID-19 pandemic have a new idea. Not content with killing 1.2 million Americans and countless others around the world, they want to intensify the China model that was largely responsible. That model, featuring Chinese communist-style lockdowns and vaccine mandates, was recommended for the rest of us by its handpicked leader of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus. And in 60 days, the CCP and globalists in Davos, Brussels, and embedded in the U.S. government planned to give him unprecedented power to dictate public health policy worldwide. If they can get two treaties adopted in May, Tedros would be able to compel compliance with a China model 2.0, featuring surveillance, censorship, and other totalitarian control techniques that will crush our sovereignty and freedoms in the name of global governance. Say no way at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. Dr. Meryl Ness, I'm very pleased to say, is still with us. She is a frontline doctor, a freedom fighter, really, and a great patriot. And it's been my privilege to work with her at our, among other things, Sovereignty Coalition. She's the founder of Door to Freedom at doortofreedom.org. You can find an extraordinary wealth of information about all the things that we're talking about here. In particular, the dangers associated with these not one, but two treaties that the Biden administration is pretty much secretly negotiating and hopes to foist upon us at the end of May without your knowledge, without debate, without your assent. And we're going to give you some more reasons why that should be completely unacceptable to all of us in this conversation as it continues with Dr. Meryl Ness. Meryl, one of the things that I think is so important to understand is that these treaties, I think, are being advanced. There's amendments to regulations, and then there's this pandemic agreement. The Congressional Research Service says they're both binding and under international law should be considered treaties. They're both going to render Tedros Ghebreyesus the sole arbiter of what constitutes a so-called public health emergency of international concern and what must be done about it. Could you give us a sense of the kinds of things he's already indicated, even before he gets these unbelievable powers, that he would consider to be such public health emergencies?
Let me say first that we are basing this information on the drafts available to us. We don't know what they're negotiating now. There's a lot of secrecy. So what I say now may not be what they vote on in May, could be a lot worse. But at the moment, the documents, the powers that are given to Tedros in these documents are to declare a public health emergency of regional or international concern on whatever basis he wants. There are no standards built in. And this is what he did with monkeypox. He wanted to declare a public health emergency. His expert team voted twice that there was no public health emergency. He declared it anyway. He claimed that a 6-9 vote was close to a tie and he had to break the tie. You know, the guy can't shoot straight. He never shoots straight.
He's a Marxist, for one thing.
Pardon? He's a Marxist, but you know, he lies. He consistently lies and with new lies and old lies. He has declared three public health emergencies of international concern in the 6 years that he's been the director general. In the whole of the 20th century, we only had three pandemics, and two of them were barely noticed. The only one we really care about is 1918, and yet he's willing to declare them every 2 years, which then will give him enormous powers and more money.
Yeah. But so Meryl, the problem is it's not just pandemics, isn't it? I mean, he's got these other things that he wants to address under his sweeping new powers, too. Tell us a little bit about
that. Exactly. So the concept of One Health has been brought in. It's a very bizarre concept which says human health can no longer be thought of as only human health, but we have to consider the effects of animals, plants, and ecosystems on health. And so this would potentially give Tedros the power to declare ecosystem emergencies or livestock emergencies or biodiversity emergencies. He can also they've expanded the definition of a public health emergency or pandemic to include anything with the potential to increase the risk. So that means, gun violence, all sorts of things, climate emergencies, climate change, pollution emergencies. Mm-hmm. And then again, he declares it, and then he tells you what you must do to obey him to deal with it.
So this raises the question that often occurs when we make presentations like this to Americans. They say, well, how can he make us do these things? I mean, this is against our Constitution, and you've indicated that you think at least in five different ways. But what enforcement mechanisms are built into this, set of agreements?
So what they've done is only hint at enforcement mechanisms. So Tedros talks about them, that we have to make the countries accountable. You know, we have to have a compliance committee, an implementation committee, a focal point in each country to make sure the country is carrying out our orders. But they don't tell you what the punishments are going to be, and they don't tell you what the financial costs are to each country, because you might not vote in favor. So those are all to be established later. But if you sign on the dotted line, you're accepting all sorts of future rules that are going to be promulgated by committees that may not include anyone from your country.
Yeah, or your assent by any means. There's be no accountability here at all. And Meryl, I'm reminded that Barack Obama, shortly before he was elected to the presidency the first time, made a profoundly ominous statement to the effect that we were at that time just 5 days away from, quote, fundamentally transforming the United States of America, unquote. It's arguably the most fundamental transformation we've ever been subjected to that would, arrive as a result of buying into these ideas that some foreign international bureaucrat, totally unaccountable to us, not elected by us, not having any real responsibility to us at all, will now be the arbiter of public health in our country and impacting that, doctor-patient relationship, as you said earlier. Global governance is the rubric under which this is being discussed. Yes. As you understand it, if they are going to enforce these arrangements, perhaps through a digital gulag, as our friend Reggie Littlejohn has called it, that is also part of the apparatus that's being put into place here, do you think they would be able to pull off the kind of fundamental transformation that the left here and the Tedroses and global governance types around the world have in mind?
I think absolutely they can do it legally. And if the Biden administration or the Obama proxy administration or whoever's running the show it continues to run the show, they will pull it off because they are the ones who initiated this process with the WHO. This is a Biden administration effort initially.
Well, in fact, you shared with me an insight that actually on his way out the door, Obama actually sort of kicked all this off. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah. So during the Obama administration, this whole notion of a global biosecurity agenda being necessary came to be. And the United States started pouring money into, dozens, over 50 countries to beef up their detection and response to biological warfare and pandemics. And the day before Obama left office, the Department of Health and Human Services promulgated a rule that said we are now going to define pandemics or public health emergencies in these five ways, and three of the ways had to do with the WHO declaring a public health emergency of international concern.
There you go.
And so this was put into basically U.S. law. I mean, it's a rule issued by an agency, but it's essentially law. And 17 AGs, Republican Attorneys General, discovered it in 2022 and petitioned DHHS to change it but they would not. And
Naturally.
So that rule is still in force.
In place.
Thank you. We are subject to some of this transformation to a global governance system through the WHO already. It's just that the noose hasn't been tightened. You know, the key hasn't been turned in the lock yet, but the legal structures are being put in place, not only here, but around the world, so that when everything is ready,
Include, just to close up here,
and
those
include the digital money is the
surveillance.
Key.
Yeah, yeah.
That
the
will
central
do
bank
it
digital currency. Yeah.
As Merrill, soon as they
we're out of time.
Do the China thing, we're toast.
You got it. We need to fight it. We've got 60 days to do it, folks. Go to sovereigntycoalition.org to find out how you can help. God bless you, Merrill Ness. Doortofreedom.org is her resource. Check it out. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. And I have a breaking news item that came to my attention after we finished our interview with Dr. Merrill Ness. An important development. The state of Louisiana, the Senate there has voted by, I believe, a 37-0 vote to basically tell the World Health Organization to go get stuffed if they think that Louisianans are going to be subjected to the kind of medical tyranny that their global governance scheme involves. This is very heartening. I hope this model will be adopted widely elsewhere across the country. Obviously, to become law, it has to be approved by the House in Louisiana, and we'll be watching that closely in the days to come. But I just wanted to share with you this good news, because this fundamentally is at the root of it all. In no small measure, a state's rights issue, as well as the rights of the American people. So we salute the Louisiana Senate, and we wish that they have every success, both in their own state, as well as an inspiration to others. This brings me to topic A that I want to get into with our next guest. His name is Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps retired. A senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, senior, very important contributor to the work of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. He's also been very active in other lines of work. After he left the Marine Corps, he became a foreign service officer. After that, he became a businessman in East Asia. He knows his way around, particularly the China beat, as you can tell, not least by a quick look at his important new book, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. And the warning that I'm currently sounding with great urgency, Colonel Newsham, is that we are just 60 days away from having the World Health Organization basically under the direction of a Chinese cat's paw by the name of Tedros Ghebreyesus, and with the strong backing of both the Chinese Communist Party and the World Economic Forum and the European Union and Bill Gates and Big Pharma, and of course, the Biden administration, to effect this sweeping transformation of our country and its constitutional form of government but actually, you know, subject the entire world to a new kind of health-driven tyranny. What are your thoughts about how this fits into the Chinese Communist Party's agenda, notably what Xi Jinping talks about as, quote, global governance, unquote?
Well, it would be a sort of an early Christmas present for the Chinese. It is that bad. It's hard to think of anything much worse. China would love it. And they've got the empirical evidence for how well this can work, which they saw during the Chinese COVID virus sort of imprisonment of Americans. It could be
the China model, it was called.
Well, that's true. And you remember how too many Americans and even some in Congress on Capitol Hill were fawning or just in awe of what the Chinese had accomplished. Mm-hmm. This would just be an absolute disaster. They've got their guy, for example, who's not even a medical doctor, who did their bidding during the entire sort of COVID experience. And he's still in power, amazingly enough, still has his job. But you saw the effect that this had. And always remember what America was like before the virus, before we committed suicide. The economy was firing on all 12 cylinders. Everything was going right. The Chinese were on the back foot. People were finally realizing even that America didn't really need China all that much. We had them. And it all changed in an instant. And it was that influence that World Health Organization had in particular. And they're the ones that could have made, if it was a competent organization, honestly run, they'd have not done what China told them to, but they did. And what exactly is it about, say, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, that would give anyone any confidence, any reason to say, yeah, I'll do what you say? There simply is no justification for them. That doesn't even get into the legal issues. This is as contrary to American freedoms and interests as anything you can imagine. China loves it. They can call the shots. They can control our economy, and they can even control what sort of drugs we are forced to take. Mm-hmm. And they are working on drugs that are going to kill us. And my goodness, it could not be better for them. And I would have to say that if there's anyone on Capitol Hill going for this, who was, you know, and I'll speak for the few Marines on the former Marines on the Democrat side, or even on the Republican side, but take the Democrat ones as well, who vote with all the regularity of an old member of the Soviet Politburo. They always go along with it. These guys ought to be ashamed of themselves. They can call themselves communists or traitors, but don't call themselves Marines. And I'll just speak for those guys. And they vote in lockstep with the administration. And it's breathtaking. And this is really something that I don't think you all are overstating this one bit, the threat that this has to American freedoms, just in every respect.
So. Yeah. Well, thank you, Colonel. That's such an important, you know, sort of cri de coeur. And I appreciate especially your calling out people who are, like you and I, under oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And they are violating that oath if they do what the World Health Organization has in mind and the Biden administration and so on. Colonel, I've got so much more to talk with you, but I do have to pivot on from that topic A, but I thank you really for your extraordinary, as usual, clarity on the matter. I did want to ask you next about, speaking of China's friends in the United States, the captured elite were much in evidence in Beijing, I believe, the past 24 hours, where Xi Jinping was holding court with American business leaders, somewhat reminiscent of the fawning that he was given with the welcome he received in San Francisco a couple of months ago. Tell us what he's now conveying to these masters of the universe and business leaders and, other members of the captured elite in America.
This is like an intelligence test for stupid people. he is summoned his guys to tell them that this market is great, China's great, you got to keep being here. And the fact they went in the first place tells you plenty. And the fact that none of them are speaking up publicly about what they really know about China says very much about them. But he needs this foreign investment. He isn't calling them just for fun. He needs it. And so he is operating.
It's kind of a bailout, isn't it?
That's exactly what it is. You know, he would not be doing this if he wasn't having a case of the shorts. He just doesn't have enough money, doesn't have enough investment, doesn't have enough convertible currency. And they are having a situation where even a lot of foreign firms now are hedging their bets. There is more sort of money going out of China, more business going out of China for other locations than there's ever been. And so it's, look at it that way. But he's, you know, he knows these guys, and he knows how they have been willing to do anything for him. And he has summoned them because he needs help, despite no matter how confident he appears.
Colonel, there's so much here that I want to explore with you. Is it that the money is coming out, or is it that the money, new money, isn't going in as it has in the past, or is it a bit of both?
It's actually some of both. You know, these companies, many of them, the financial guys are different. I'd say the guys who run these big investment financial firms, they're different. They're just amoral. And they would do business with Lucifer himself if they could cash the check. But people who actually run companies that make things, they're the ones that are looking for alternative places to make this stuff. And so it's some of each. So some money is going out, some business is going out, but also that new money is not going in anymore. And that's got China's attention.
So to the extent that they're in need of a bailout, and they are still receiving some, at least from the financial mavens, is this an instance of, again, missing an opportunity to help the people of China, dispose of this Communist Party that has brutally oppressed them for decades and threatens us mortally as well?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's an opportunity that comes around, and they don't come around all the time, and you can't count on them coming around in the future. If you don't take advantage of these opportunities to hurt your enemy, and they call us an enemy all the time, and that's how they view us. If you don't take advantage of the opportunity to protect yourself, well, then you should expect to lose. And that's how I would look at this.
And I guess that's the key question. You've written, as I mentioned, Colonel, this extraordinarily important book about when, not if, when China attacks, playing out scenarios and explaining what the stakes are for us. Missing this opportunity may well mean our last chance to have a very different outcome than the Chinese Communist Party has in mind. Colonel, when we come back, I want to just visit with you about the current thinking on your part about whether the difficulties Xi is experiencing are making war more likely, and not just in Taiwan, but perhaps here as well. Be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsom. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The people who brought us the COVID-19 pandemic have a new idea. Not content with killing 1.2 million Americans and countless others around the world, they want to intensify the China model that was largely responsible. That model, featuring Chinese communist-style lockdowns and vaccine mandates, was recommended for the rest of us by its handpicked leader of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus. And in 60 days, the CCP and globalists in Davos, Brussels, and embedded in the U.S. government plan to give him unprecedented power to dictate public health policy worldwide. If they can get two treaties adopted in May, Tedros would be able to compel compliance with a China Model 2.0, featuring surveillance, censorship, and other totalitarian control techniques that will crush our sovereignty and freedoms in the name of global governance. Say no way at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, a great friend of this program and colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, is in the house with us. We are having an extended conversation with him, for which I'm very grateful. And Colonel, I was just asking you, you've written about when China attacks, and I know part of that book is a cautionary message to the nation to try to assure that it doesn't happen by taking the sorts of steps that would deter it. But we've been exploring this over the months, including, I think, in one or more of our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars. You're, of course, an important member of that group. Are we, in fact, to take some comfort from the financial difficulties, economic, population, and others, of course, but particularly financial difficulties Xi Jinping is in? Or do you think currently that this probably makes war more likely at his hands?
Well, I'm always glad to see people who don't like me having trouble. You know, it's better than the alternative, so that's a good thing.
Right.
But does that restrain him? I'm not so sure about that. I think Xi and the Chinese Communist Party have been trying to sanctions-proof their economy for a long time, and they can absorb a lot of punishment. I think that it is, say, so it's not a restraint. And looked at, say, in the totality of things going on, as Xi might see it, he also looks at the state we're in, the state of our domestic circumstances, the state of the other free nations and how they might respond. He looks at how this mass of other lesser countries, what are they thinking? And an awful lot of them, if you go by the numbers, do actually support China. And he may think that, well, this is my chance. And it wouldn't, he doesn't look, I think, at the economy as an obstacle. And I think if he looks at everything else and the ability of people to stop him, either preemptively or even after the fact, and he may think, well, this is the time. And once I've got this out of the way, well, we can turn to the economy if that needs fixed. But in the meantime, people can tighten their belts. So I think the people who dismiss the possibility that China's economic difficulties will sort of not encourage them, the possibility that because of the economic situation, they wouldn't, that means they won't attack. I think it just as much means they will, that they're going to look at other things. But I think this is not a bad distraction from other problems that he's got.
Well, and that is, in fact, as you know so well, Colonel, the sort of safety valve tyrants have often resorted to, is to find that distraction, find that foreign boogeyman that they can get people to rally around the flag, support the regime. And in a time such as this, that's very much what they're likely to opt for. I think we agree. But it brings us back to this point, all the more reason why we should be encouraging the Chinese people not to fall for this, not to go there. It's really a great peril to us if they do. And that brings me to another topic, sir, that I wanted just to visit with you about. You've spent in your course of your military career a lot of time on big vessels, I know, naval vessels. I think the Marines call the Navy the sea lift aspect of your operation.
But we used to, you know, when they had boats. But
when they were in that line of work. That's not actually a laughing matter, unfortunately. Yeah. But Colonel, of course, a big boat slammed into an important bridge in Baltimore Harbor and has closed the harbor at the moment, trapping inside it, as it happens, some number of our fast sea lift assets, by the way. We don't know at the moment exactly what went down. But I imagine you've been putting some attention to it, and I wondered what your thoughts were, both as to whether there may have been, you know, some malevolent action involved, not just an accident, but also what it tells us more generally about the kind of vulnerabilities, particularly our infrastructure, has to deliberate actions of sabotage.
In terms of what happened in Baltimore the other day, I don't know. I wouldn't rule anything out. And that's always the safe thing to do, is don't rule anything out. But it could have just been, you know, sort of the ship lost power, lost control, and hit a bridge and the bridge came down. Those things happen. That is possible. But you'd need to look into this thoroughly, and to include particularly the cyber angle. And this doesn't always get the attention it deserves. And that's where I would pay a lot of attention. Just to make sure. But regardless, the bad guys, they're not stupid. They're as smart as we are. And they like what they see from this bridge, the Key, it's Francis Scott Key Bridge going down. And this is just Baltimore. And this is just one bridge. There's a lot of ports that are vulnerable. In fact, all of them just about. And beyond the ports, you also have our domestic infrastructure, particularly the transport infrastructure. And there's, say, key bridges in certain areas, say, even in Nebraska. You know, this is places where there's, say, only like two ways to get across a state with any efficiency. Mm-hmm. And they probably have got these things scouted out. And it's our, we have just assumed that our domestic infrastructure, it's safe because it was in World War II. Which is the last experience that we had. And there's not many people alive who remember that very well. And so we just assume that we're safe in the homeland. And that is as big a mistake as you can possibly make.
Especially when we've witnessed tens of thousands, by some estimates, of military-aged men, unaccompanied, coming into this country across particularly our southern border. It is the height of folly, as I think you have said on this program, and I know elsewhere, Colonel, that we disregard the clear, menacing implications of that. And I fear that that's precisely what we're doing. There seems to be no effort underway to identify these folks, where they are, what they're actually up to, and certainly nothing underway to get them out of the country. As I think 10 former senior executives of the FBI urged a couple of months ago, must be done as a matter of, frankly, the utmost urgency. Colonel, we have to take a final break. We'll be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsham on what is, in fact, now in the future for us here at home, as well as in the Western Pacific. Stay tuned for that and more right after this. We're back, and we are visiting for one more block with our friend Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, retired. Colonel, we were, I think, just discussing the prospects that war might, in fact, be in the offing with the Chinese Communist Party. If anything, it seems more likely by the day, both for the internal reasons and the calculations of what the external opportunities are. One of the things that is another weapon in this war, another weapon, unrestricted warfare technique, if you will, that they have been wielding to bring about our demise without firing a shot, is something that's gotten a lot of attention here in recent days, as I think you know, namely TikTok. And you've spent time in the tech business. You, I think, have a deep understanding of sort of the political warfare acumen and capabilities of the Chinese Communist Party. What do you say to those who argue that, well, this is a free speech issue and America must not do anything to try to constrain America's young people especially, but by some estimates, 173 million of us from using this particular platform?
Well, this is an effort, or it's an opportunity, mechanism by which an enemy can mentally influence a huge chunk of our population and a huge chunk of the younger population in particular, who are going to grow up and be the ones who run the country. And why would anyone allow that? You know, there's obviously, there's been...
Could I just ask you, sir, you said they could. I mean, you said can, I think. Oh, yeah. The question is that what they're doing right now?
Oh, are they, I think, in fact, that
manipulating our young people, among others?
Well, I think that's pretty clear that is being done. It's obviously, it's sort of tucked into this sort of larger barrage of things like cats and videos of cats and dogs, etc. But within that, some part of that is where you get, let's say, you can insert the message. And if you control what people are hearing, you know, it's not like they're going to think anything different. And it is another early Christmas present for the Chinese. And it's interesting just how much attention is being paid to this now by a lot of people on Capitol Hill. Of course, there's other apps, and there will be other apps, you know, even if they go after this one. But look how hard it's been to do anything about this. The Indians closed TikTok down a few years ago in about 24 hours. Mm. And here we have this phalanx of lobbyists and lawyers that do the Chinese Communist Party's bidding. But this is a way to shape thinking, to shape people's minds. And any fight is half mental. And it's not a question of hardware or anything else, but if you can get the people to think a certain way, I mean, you don't even need to fight. And this is the tool with which they do it. Yeah. And so,
Colonel,
here we are later.
Let me just ask you on this point. We did a webinar. I can't remember whether you were a contributor to it or not. You've done so many of them. We're so grateful to you for that. This one, like all of them, is available at presentdangerchina.org. And I encourage you folks, if you haven't already done so, to subscribe. Make sure you don't miss a single one of them. But in this particular program that we did about TikTok, Grant, one of the things that came across powerfully to me was this isn't just about, getting their hands on everybody's big data, as they say. It isn't just even about having this highly addictive algorithm that they've used to, you know, get your attention and to be sometimes subliminally sending you messages, but that there's actually a degree of mind control that is operating now. And I keep thinking about, you know, the concerns many of us have about the prospects of a free and fair election. If people are unwittingly being programmed to vote a certain way. Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Manchurian candidates, even a Manchurian president in Joe Biden, but we've got Manchurian voters, I fear. How seriously should we be concerned about that?
Well, you should be very concerned about it. It subverts or perverts the entire notion of a free and fair election. And that's even by international standards. This is something that allows our enemy to put their finger on the scale and really direct the way a huge chunk of the population thinks and votes. And this isn't so you have elections that are not in as they're supposed to be. People look at both sides' arguments and they, this is fair exchange of ideas or competition, and they, whichever side is more persuasive wins. That's the theory. And it's worked pretty well. But here you have something where an outside force actually, you know, has this direct pipe into the thinking of the electorate, into what they hear. And this
getting news from it, no less, as they say.
If you control what people hear, control the news, that what they are taking to be news, which tells them what they use to make their decisions about how they ought to choose a candidate or not choose a candidate, that it's hard to think of just how much worse it can get. And to allow this to happen under some guise of, well, it's just free speech. Well, I've heard that argument. That's the same argument, almost the same argument that people use to cancel people. Well, it's just, yes. It's a commercial interest. It's, but this is a case where, you know, it's really unfortunate to watch an entire nation or a good chunk of itself let itself be hypnotized effectively and go along with it. Yeah. And it's the ideal for the bad guys, because if you can get the other side to think that they're your target, to think they're acting of their own free will and be convinced of that, and to think that they have some constitutional right to this,
more to the point,
that it just gets even better for them. And
better for the bad guys, worse for us, of course, all the way.
Yes.
Colonel, we have to wrap with that. I think this is such an important topic. And I, again, as with everything we do together, I value your insights as well as the courageous way in which you put forward your insights. It's incredibly needed at a moment such as this. And I know you'll keep it up with us, among others, at the Committee on the Present Danger of China, and of course, our Center for Security Policy.org as well. Thank you. Keep it up, my friend, and come back to us again very soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. That until then, you'll go forth and multiply.